Days blurred past, and before they knew it, February was upon them. After the initial excitement of the student exodus and the Duelist Society's foundation, the routine and rhythm of school life was a comfort, restoring equilibrium from a world that had looked a bit like it was tipping in the first week of the term. Utena had heard legends of C-term, how since the days when WPI was the site of a technical college, since the 20th century, the third term of the year was a time of bad luck, high emotion, and pain for the Institute's students. But so far, aside from the continued insipid muckraking in the Beacon, everything seemed to be going very well. It made the more experienced students a little nervous. Devlin, in particular, seemed like he was always looking out for the other shoe to drop. In the third week of the term, the odd, plastic-shrouded kiosks which had been scattered around campus during winter break were unveiled and explained in a campus-wide announcement by President Tiefeld. The Institute had been made the gift of a sophisticated autonomous cybernetic intelligence computer system by the government of the Earth Alliance through an educational grant program. That system, installed in the basement of Fuller Laboratories, was billed as a socially interactive organization and information system, which basically meant it was to serve the same function as the old Hyperbox mainframe, student email, news, and such, except with the ability to make chit-chat, dispense information anybody could find in the student handbook or course catalog, and sysadmin itself, freeing up the campus computing staff to tackle more interesting issues than finding out who hacked the Campus Crusade for Kalidor's student organization website this week. The system would be reachable from any computer attached to the campus network. Any computer on the galactic internet could communicate with it, really. But the kiosks were there so that students roaming the campus between classes and the like, away from the labs and common areas, could make inquiries of it if need be. The computer was named Durandal, and it struck most students, as they got to know it in the early part of the term, as rather smug and sarcastic for a system whose job was basically to route student email and control the automatic doors in the Fuller Labs building. It seemed to take a liking to the Duelists and their friends for some reason, and occasionally did them small favors it wasn't supposed to do for students, like retrieving accidentally deleted files from the master backups, and intercepting and destroying the occasional missent email message. They got used to it fairly quickly. Corwin visited every Saturday, though he'd missed the last one, January 29th, because of some kind of class project back in Crescent Heights, citing concern for Dorothy as his major motivation. Dorothy, however, was doing okay, all things considered. She required no repairs. Miki and Moose were more than competent to maintain her with the auto bay. She was glad to see him in her understated way, but with the help of the others of Galaxy House, she was getting along quite well. He came, checked in with her, received her assurances that she was well and had no need of his help just now, then spent most of his visiting time in Morgan 412. Our Dorothy Wainwright's classes that term centered mainly around history and literature studies, as those, along with music theory, were what she found most interesting. Mathematics bored her, since her floating-point subprocessor made them trivial, but the intellectual subjects she could sink her mental teeth into. One of the great ironies of her existence was that her positronic matrix was so complex, her AI so sophisticated, that she could actually forget things. And so, if she didn't use cybernetic methods to write them in permanently, if she simply read and tried to understand like a human would, she had to make an effort to learn things, just like a human would. She found the process rather enjoyable. Today she was applying that effort to 20th Century Earth Literature 2, a class she shared with only one real acquaintance, Devlin Carter. Dorothy still didn't know Devlin all that well, but he considered her a friend all the same. He seemed to enjoy spending time with her, even if she didn't talk much. That was all right. He liked to talk, and she listened. They would sit in the student lounge in Salisbury Labs, where most of the lit classes were held, and read. Devlin sometimes read aloud from their assignments, doing voices and occasionally sound effects. Other times, neither one said anything at all. Devlin's friends had started to notice that his comic opera Lord Peter Wimsey accent tended to mute itself a bit when he spoke to Dorothy. His exaggerated mannerisms moderate themselves somewhat, and they wondered. But Amanda Dessler didn't seem concerned. Devlin stifled a yawn as Professor Harris, the selfsame Professor Harris who was the fencing club's advisor, nattered on about the terrific importance of Raymond Chandler's writings in the development of the 22nd century's post-postmodern pulp transfigurational movement. Why couldn't the bugger focus a bit more on the fact that Chandler just wrote cracking good internal monologues? There are blondes and blondes, and it is almost a joke word today. As though summoned by the thought, a little blonde freshman girl, Devlin dimly recognized, entered the room, looking very apologetic. She said a few hushed words to the professor, handed him a note, and scuttled out again. Harris stood there, read the note, read it again, then put it slowly down on the desk before him and turned to face the class. "Dorothy Wainwright," he said, his voice odd and cold. "Yes," said Dorothy. "I've just been informed that you are more properly addressed as Robot Dorothy Wainwright. Is this true?" "Yes," said Dorothy. "I see. And why," said the professor, more coldly still, "did you not see fit to inform this class, and especially your instructor, of this fact?" "Is there a requirement that I do? None of the other students have been required to give details of their species or origin," Dorothy replied. "None of the other students are non-life forms," said Harris. "This says you're not even Turing certified. Is that true?" "Yes." "Who is your master?" asked Harris harshly, all trace of human warmth vanishing from his voice. "Corwin Ravenhair of New Avalon," Dorothy replied promptly. "Your local master, then. You must have one. You couldn't be on this planet without someone here to be responsible for you."
"Corwin's sister, Caitlin Hutchins."
Harris scowled. "I might have known. Is there nothing that young woman won't mock? First she thumbs her nose at the Institute's sporting traditions, and now I discover that since the first day of the term she's been causing me to waste my time and energy trying to teach an appliance to appreciate literature. A fine joke!"
"You've been succeeding," Dorothy told him calmly. "My understanding of Chandler
is a cleverly programmed imitation of the responses of the real students in this class," Harris interrupted her. "Remove yourself from my class, machine. Your mistress's joke is done. Tell her I don't appreciate the humor."
Dorothy rose, her face still utterly impassive. "It's hardly a secret what I am," she said. "My artifaction certificate and operational parameters are on file with the admissions office and the office of the Dean of Students. Several of my fellow students are fully aware. Perhaps if you researched your students—"
"Be silent!" Harris snapped. "You're out of this class. Other members of this faculty may be willing to waste their time attempting to educate a damned mindless piece of machinery, but I'm not, and I certainly won't stand here debating my duties as an instructor with one. Out!" "I say, see here now," said Devlin, rising to his feet. "Dorothy hasn't caused any trouble, sir. She's one of the best students in this class, what? You couldn't tell she's a robot in 4 weeks of classes. Why get yourself all in a bundle over it now?"
Harris turned his glare on Devlin, arching his eyebrows. "Are you going to tell me how to do my job now, Mr. Carter?" Devlin flushed. "It seems to me you could use a few pointers," he said, then added, "Sir?" Dorothy, who hadn't paused when Devlin rose, completed her exit, closing the door behind her.
"Enough," Harris snarled. "Out with you two, and don't come back. You fail for the term. Make sure you're in Professor Chandrigan's division when you make up the course."
"Oh, righto,"
said Devlin, his anger rigidly concealed behind a layer of clearly false bonhomie, as he shoveled his books into his bag and slung it over his shoulder.
"The Dean of Students will be hearing about this, eh, what? Abuse of authority and all that. Man's got a right to stand up for a friend, old man.
Robots don't have friends, said Harris with a sneer. If you're fool enough to be taken in by the fact that it wears a pretty face, I don't want you in my class.
Well, then I'd say we're even, what?
Devlin replied as he passed the professor's desk.
I don't want your instruction.
He slammed the door behind him, looked around, saw Dorothy's back vanishing out the far door into Freeman Plaza, and sprinted after her, calling for her to wait. She didn't.
Dorothy, where are you going?
He called to her, running after her. Fortunately, though she hadn't stopped when he asked, she was only walking, if briskly. He fell into step beside her, panting a little, as she reached West Street.
Home, Dorothy said. That was my last class today. Home? But we've got to report this to the dean, Devlin protested. That bastard can't get away with treating you that way.
Of course he can, Dorothy replied flatly. There's no law that says he has to speak to me, let alone teach me. He's right, I'm not a person, only a thing.
Like hell you're not!
Devlin rounded her and stopped in front of her, his hands on her shoulders. She kept walking for a couple of steps, shoving him effortlessly back along the sidewalk, before halting to regard him with a mildly puzzled expression as he continued,
I don't give a damn what that robophobic prick Harris says, or what the law says. I haven't spent the last month studying Chandler with a mindless recorder. You have insights, Dorothy. You have ideas and feelings. You're my friend, and I won't let him run roughshod over you like that.
Dorothy regarded him steadily for a few seconds, as if only now considering how he had been able to follow her with slightly less than half the class period expired.
You got thrown out, didn't you? She said. That's right. And I'm not going back. I wouldn't go back if Aaron Bloody Harris got down on his knees and begged me. Now come on, let's go to Boynton and report this.
No, said Dorothy, shrugging gently but firmly free. You can report it if you want to, but I'm going home. See you at dinner. Then she walked around him and on down the hill. With a strangled, frustrated noise, Devlin kicked a chunk of congealed snow thrown up onto the sidewalk by the snowplow, then ran up to Boynton Hall, the administration building.
Damn it, Utanatenjo grumbled. I knew something like this was going to happen. If only Corwin and I could have convinced her to get certified before coming, she should have told him exactly where to shove his attitude and how far up.
Devlin let his head fall back against the wedge bench with a painful-sounding thump.
I know, he said, and the hell of it is there's no recourse now. Oh, Dean Montaigne will have some words with the professor about his high-handed style and lack of social graces, but he won't have to take her back.
I wouldn't go back to a teacher who treated me like that anyway, said Caitlin. I'd go see if Professor Chandrigan would let me finish the term in his division.
That's what I'm planning to do, said Devlin. Dean Montaigne said she couldn't do much for either of us, but she could at least get the failing grades Harris will be giving us wiped out, and Chandrigan's already said he'll take us.
He sighed. Ah, hell, I don't know. I'm not a violent man. Quite a coward, actually. Terrified of physical conflict. But I would so very much have liked to take a swing at Harris. He was so bloody awful to her. Right there in front of everybody. He might at least have had the decency to dismiss her in private if he felt he had to do it at all. Eh? What?
Not that I really want to play devil's advocate, said Utina. But if he really believes she doesn't have feelings, it might just not have occurred to him.
No, said Devlin, shaking his head. No, it wasn't like that. You didn't see his face or hear his voice. He was enjoying it. Being deliberately cruel, what? I'd swear to it. He knew, or at least believed, hoped. He was hurting her, humiliating her, like he felt her presence in his class with him all unaware had humiliated him. Miki Kaworu came by then, looking a bit worried and distracted. He peered around the wedge booth, not at the people, but at their bags and belongings, then moved on, clicking his watch. "What's up, Miki?" asked Uchina. "Lose something?" He turned, the worry more evident on his face. "I can't find my notebook," he said. "Which one?" "The green one." "Oh." Now Uchina looked a little troubled too, as did Cade. Miki's green notebook was his music notebook, the only possession, other than his old Atori Academy uniform and the watch that had been in its top pocket, that he'd managed to bring with him from Sephiro. The early part of it, from before his translation out of his homeworld, contained the beginnings of several new collaborations he'd started with his recently reconciled twin sister Kozue. Even aside from that, music to Miki was like stray thoughts to most people. He'd jotted down bits of musical notation all the time, some to flesh out for later, some to leave fallow, others just to get them out of his head. To someone who could read and appreciate the significance of music, Miki's notebook was a roadmap to his soul. If he'd managed to lose it, he'd have lost more than just a few works in progress.
"When was the last time you saw it?" asked Kate.
"Yesterday evening, I think," said Miki. "I had it at rehearsal, and for the duelist meeting afterward. I can't remember if I had it in my room last night, but I must have. I'd have noticed if I hadn't brought it back with me. No, I know I had it, because I remember putting it in my pack before I came up the hill this morning."
"Did you take it out any time today?" asked Uchina.
"Of course I did. I take it out and put it back all the time," Miki told her. "It's automatic. But I went to take it out in physics, and it wasn't there."
"What was the class you had before that?" asked Devlin.
"Galactic History 203, said Miki, Uchina, and Kate, with slightly imperfect unison from the last, together. "We've all got GH 203 at 1, Uchina went on. "Sayanji's in that division, too. I think I saw it there," she said.
"Hmm," said Kate, nodding. "I know you had it, at least before the break."
"Did you look in Kinnikut?" Uchina inquired. Galactic History 203 was a large class, over 100 students in each division, and so was held in Salisbury Lab's auditorium-style lecture hall.
"I practically turned it upside down. Professor Henderson said he hasn't seen it, and he always makes sure no one's left anything behind after his class is let out. I just came from looking through the band offices in Alden Hall. I can't imagine where I can have left it. It must have fallen out of my bag or something. It could be anywhere."
Calm down, said Uchina. "We'll go look over the paths you walk today before it gets too dark to see. Hey, Sayanji," she called, arresting the progress of the green-haired young man as he crossed the wedge. He vectored toward the booth instead of continuing on toward the Daniels Hall mailboxes, as it seemed to be his intent when he entered, with a question on his face.
"Miki's misplaced his green notebook," Uchina told him. "Come on and help us look for it before it gets dark."
"Certainly," he said, nodding. They scoured the main campus from end to end, tracing the paths that Miki would have walked as he passed from class to lunch and so forth in the course of the day, and came up empty. Then they retraced the path again, having maximized their use of the waning daylight, to check the buildings he'd entered. By 6 they were tired and hungry, and had found no trace of the notebook. Miki fretted through dinner, had a very unproductive evening of trying to study, and finally borrowed one of Kate's blank staff notebooks so he could at least keep making notes and not go totally mad.
"Cheer up, Miki," Uchina encouraged him. "Someone's bound to have found it. It's got your name in it, right? They'll turn it into the mailroom or the campus police. It'll turn up."
"I hope you're right," he said, but he sounded unconvinced. It took 2 days for the first page to appear. On Thursday night, the 3rd of February, they found it on their way into Alton Hall for an Art of Noise rehearsal. It was nailed to the hall's front door like Martin Luther's tracts,
fluttering slightly in a winter breeze. For a second, Caitlin took it for another one of the Campus Crusade for Calidor's vehement tracts, until she realized it had music on it, and familiar music at that. Miki recognized it an instant later, after she did, and sprang for the door with a strangled shout.
This is page 3 of Duet for Piano Number 17, he cried.
He couldn't remove the nail with his fingers, so he carefully tore the nail hole through to remove the page. He turned toward the others, cradling the wounded page in his hands, his face ashen.
How did it get here?
I don't know, Kate admitted, her face covered in mixed concern for her friend and anger that someone would do something like this to his most prized possession.
But we'll find out.
Over the next several days, more pages appeared in odd and foreboding places. Two were mailed to Mickey's campus mailbox, postmarked from far-flung and exotic locales. One appeared on Table 11 in the Morgan Hall Dining Commons, the IBGF's usual table, before dinner on Friday. Azalin found one stuck under Riley 212's door upon returning from classes Monday afternoon. Caitlin discovered one wedged between two of the small pipes of Alden Hall's organ. Another turned up taped to the window on Galaxy House's front door. One, folded neatly into a very airworthy paper glider, sailed into Olin 218 through the open lintel over the door to lodge in Professor Jellicoe's beehive, and narrowly escaped being balled up and thrown into the trash by its desperate owner's frantic leap. As the week went on, Miki got more and more upset. He carefully collated the pages they found and fitted them into a report binder, slowly piecing the book back together. There seemed to be no rhyme or reason to the order in which the pages had been torn out. Some were from early in the notebook, some late. One, the one that had been stuck in the organ, was blank. Miki became moody, swinging between jittery nervousness, undirected anger, and bleak despair. The rest of the Federation tended to hover between the same state of anger and an agony of concern, for the boy genius was going to pieces.
I bet I know who's responsible for this, Kate announced from her bed one evening.
Hm? Said Utina, who sat at her desk working on a report for GH-203. Kate hadn't spoken in almost an hour when she made this comment, and the context thus escaped Utina completely.
Mickey's notebook. I bet Liza Broadbent took it.
Why would she do that? Utina wondered. She doesn't even know Miki. He never did anything to her. Kate sat up and sighed wearily.
He's my friend, and yours, and Sky's housemate. That's enough for Liza. I should have realized it earlier.
I don't know, said Utina dubiously. I mean, I could see her maybe taking it, but tearing it up and leaving the pieces where he'll find them? That's awful low, even for her. That's torture.
I know, said Kate. You don't know Liza like I do.
Utina swiveled her chair and leaned back. What's the deal with you two, anyway? I mean, I've seen people hate each other that much before, but usually there was more involved than a couple of school clubs.
We've been enemies since kindergarten, Kate told her. I wasn't a very willing student my first couple of years at public school. Well, you can imagine.
Liza Broadbank was the daughter of Ephraim Broadbank, vice president for operations of the As Technology Corporation, and the number two man in charge of their corporate headquarters in New Avalon. His wife, Alicia, was one of the leading lights of the city's high society scene. Both the Broadbanks had an intense and mutual dislike for the immortal clique that ran the city, the Wedge Defense Force elder types, Griffin, Megazone, and their ilk. A lot of the corporate society types in the city did. After all, in any other city in the galaxy, they would have been calling the shots and running the show, not these weirdos, most of whom, despite their fabulous wealth, lived bizarrely middle-class lives for no readily apparent reason. The Broadbanks' three daughters, Elizabeth, Clarissa, and Marietta, each separated by 2 years from the next, had been raised to share this dislike. As luck would have it, each of them had at least one of the children of those people as a schoolmate, too. Liza was the same age as Kate, Clarissa happened to be of concurrent age with the Ragnarok crop, and Mary was contemporary with the Morgan twins and Sylvie Daniels. Worse, their parents sent them to the same primary schools, though they could have afforded far more prestigious private schooling, solely out of some perverse desire to match and mock the Wedge Defenders. In two cases out of three, this had worked out about as well as you might expect. Liza, upon arriving at Katahdin Avenue Elementary School at the age of 5, knew full well that she could have been going somewhere much higher class. Though the New Avalon public schools were very good, they weren't fancy. Were it not for the brown-haired little girl in the second row who never spoke. Thus, Caitlin had an enemy from 8 o'clock on day one, and didn't know the reason for the slim blonde's enmity for several years. Clarissa, the middle daughter, was widely acknowledged to be even worse, meaner, more vindictive, sharper-tongued than Liza. She had all the disadvantages of Liza, plus the sizable chip on her shoulder that came from being the middle child in a family as cool and remote as the Broadbanks. Strangely, the youngest daughter, Mary, had managed to overcome all this and turn out all right. She was a good friend of the Morgan twins and Sylvie. Rumor had it her father was considering disowning her for it, but that was the way the rumor mill went at Crescent Heights Middle School, and no one could be sure if it were true. "Wow, she even followed you here," said Utina, impressed. "Now that's dedication." Kate made an irritated noise. She probably thinks I left New Avalon to get away from her. "You're so vain," Utina sang. "You probably think this song is about you." That had the desired effect. Kate's scowl cracked and she giggled a little.
Exactly.
Then, sobering, she went on. "Liza doesn't like to attack her foes directly. It's usually safer and easier to attack their friends. So it's not much of a stretch to see her hand in this."
"So what do we do? Report her to the dean?"
"With what evidence?"
"The fact that it's just her style?
That's hard to explain without visual aids."
"I guess the alternative's to go beat the hell out of her. That would probably get us expelled, though."
Kate sighed again. "Maybe I'm wrong. I hope I am. But I don't know who else would do a thing like this."
The following day, Devlin reported at dinner that Miki's notebook was nowhere to be found anywhere in Founders 201, but that if anyone were interested in some rather expensive jewelry, he knew where he could get some cheap. None of those who had known him long seemed surprised by the statement, merely disappointed by his findings. Miki, after he got over being startled by the realization of how Devlin must have acquired that knowledge, pushed his food disconsolately around his plate until most of the group had finished and gone, then got up to make his morose way back to Galaxy House. Kate and Utina exchanged a sad, rather helpless glance, and were about to get up and follow him anyway when his cry rang back into the cafeteria. Kate took the long way around, running between tables, dodging seats and fellow students, and ducking around the salad bar. Utina took the short way,
jumping up onto the table, then taking long, leaping strides from table to table, reaching the desk at the entrance where the machine that goes ping was set up in about 10 seconds. She jumped down without breaking stride and pelted out of the calf, ignoring the indignant cry of the guy who operated the machine, and was at Miki's side in a moment. Kate arrived seconds later, followed by the rest, all of them with the same unasked question on their lips. It was answered the moment they saw Miki. He stood looking at the cork-backed bulletin board on the wall in the short hallway leading from the wedge into the dining hall. This was a popular place for students to put the usual things. Rideshare requests for various destinations, housing availability notices, and other important communications. Band needs bassist. Influences include Thrashing Gnoberts and P-Funk All-Stars. No weenies. I will write your term paper for non-Deka food. Mac Megacube, 256XB, Crystal Writer, trade for GameTrode XL OBO. That kind of thing. Affixed to the center of the bulletin board with a small, nasty-looking knife was a sheet of staff paper. The bottom half of the staves had music handwritten on them. The upper half was covered by a sketch, though it was hard to tell just what it was a sketch of. That end of the paper had been slashed several times by a knife, probably the same knife which had then been driven into page and corkboard alike and was still jutting out like a stake through a vampire's heart. Or Miki's. The young composer stood transfixed, staring with wide, quivering eyes at the destruction. This was the only page they had found so far that had been harmed, other than small holes in a few where they had been nailed or tacked to things. He reached a trembling hand out toward the hilt of the knife, then let it fall and turned away, covering his face. Liza Broadbank just happened to walk past at that moment, on her way through the wedge from the Daniels Student Government offices to the Quad and thence Harrington Auditorium. She saw the six of them standing around the bulletin board, saw Miki's shoulders slumped and shaking, and addressed him in a loud, carrying, slightly mocking tone of solicitude. "Not feeling well tonight, Mr. Kaworu? That's a shame." He looked up at her, dropping his hands and revealing the tears tracking his face, and tried to speak, but couldn't. She tisked in clearly false concern. "If you can't handle the pressure here at the Institute," she said, "maybe it would be best if you went home to your girlfriend." Then she turned and breezed out. Utena made an incoherent noise and began to lunge after her, with Kate not far behind, but Skaya interposed himself. "No, ladies, I beg you," he said. "It's what she wants. She's willing to take a beating if it gets one or both of you expelled. Do you understand? Don't play into her hands." Utena pushed against his restraining hand for a second, then realized he was right and sagged back, letting out an explosive sigh that may or may not have contained a profanity. She turned to Miki, who still stood, staring at where Liza had been, his jaw quivering. Then, with a single sob, he covered his eyes with his arm and ran, crossing the wedge and vanishing into the ground floor corridor that led through Daniel's hall. "Fuck," said Caitlin distinctly, and she ran after him. Utena looked as if she might follow for a second, then thought better of it, and instead went to carefully remove the page from the bulletin board and carry it to wedge bench number one. There, she carefully smoothed it out on the booth table and determined that none of it was actually missing. It had been slashed into several narrow ribbons, but none of them were detached from the sheet at both ends. "Here," said Azalin. She dug around in her bag for a moment, then handed over a roll of wide, clear tape. Utena thanked her for it, pulled off a few strips, and gingerly restored the page's structural integrity, lining up all the bits and making sure they were right before sealing the tape down over the cuts one at a time. When she was done, the sketch was complete. It was the face of a girl, in three-quarter profile, from the shoulders up. The technique of its execution was so-so. It had clearly been sketched fairly hurriedly with a blue ballpoint pen, most likely on the spur of the moment, but it captured her quite nicely anyway. A pretty girl with short, thick, rather disorderly hair, a pointed nose, and thoughtful eyes. The picture ended just below her slim throat, with just the edges of a wide-collared blouse visible before the pen strokes faded out into blankness again.
"Interesting. She looks like our friend, Mr. Kaworu," said Skaya. "If he were an egg-bearer..."
Utina gave him an odd look.
"I think you mean female, Skye."
"Sorry," said Skye, unperturbed. "In Skrangish, it's the same word. Who is she?"
"His twin sister. Sometimes humanoids are born more than one at a time."
Skye nodded. "I'm familiar with the concept, thank you."
He wasn't offended, just letting her know she didn't need to bother explaining.
"Interesting," he repeated. Utrina looked up from the maimed, bandaged page to glare with unrestricted loathing across the quad at Harrington Auditorium.
"I'd like to wring that bitch's neck," she muttered. "I should have been harder on her when we dueled."
"But if you do that, you'll be thrown out of the Institute," Moose observed. "And like Skye said, that's exactly what Liza wants."
"I know, damn it," said Utrina, banging a fist down on the table and making Azalin's roll of tape clatter. "But there's got to be something we can do."
"I don't see what," said Moose glumly. "It's not like we can prove what she's been doing. If Devlin had been able to find what's left of the book, maybe."
"Damn it," Utrina repeated,